Diane, it's Sunday, 11:58 in the morning. I'm sending you the latest episode of Season 2 of Horror Vanguard's Twin Peaks Retrospective. I think you're going to get a kick out of this one.
Beautiful.
Perfect.
Shall I lead us in?
Drive away.
Hey. It is good to be back, friends. Diane, it is 47 minutes past 7 on the evening of April the 1st, and I am re-entering the small idyllic town of Twin Peaks, joined, as always, by the Log Lady of Podcasting. Ash, how are you, my friend?
I feel like it's been 100 years since we do you know that like meme? It's I don't know if this was originally a Vine or a TikTok, but it's like the person mixing all the household cleaners in the toilet bowl, and the voice is like, "All right, I'm just gonna be doing commentary until they've killed themselves by making chlorine gas, and they're dead." And then it like slash cuts to the same person being like, "How long have you been doing this? I'm trans now." And I'm like, "Oh, that's me, but with the Twin Peaks review." How long have we been doing this, John?
Yeah, it's when this started, you were a whole different gender.
Look, I just, everything I do is in service to Horror Vanguard and our numbers, and I'm just doing this for the upcoming David Duchovny episodes.
Yes,
so I'll have more thorough commentary.
Thank you for your service. That's all I can say. But yes, long time listeners will know that we have been there has been a much delayed Twin Peaks retrospective. It was delayed for many, many months because of the WGA and SAG AFTRA strikes, when those on strike asked podcasters to not cover work from Strux Studios. So we pulled the plug on the Twin Peaks retrospective. We were up to just getting into the kind of the swing of season two, and so we are back for the retrospective, and we're going to mix things up a little bit in how we do it. So instead of kind of 20-minute mini episodes on just one episode of the show, we're going to try and go for like the full king-sized HV podcast meal, and we're going to be covering three episodes in every episode of the retrospective, just to give you more content. That's what we're up to. And now here's
I think this is. Oh, go on.
I was just going to ask you the question that I've been wanting to ask ever since we agreed to restart doing this, which is, would you mind maybe catching up listeners as to what is happening in Twin Peaks right now?
This has been so in appropriate Twin Peaks fashion, dear listeners, if you will recall our earlier episodes of the Twin Peaks retrospective, the numerical sequencing of the Twin Peaks episode uses three separate numbering systems, which is designed to induce Lovecraftian madness. By bundling three episodes into one, we add to this appropriate tradition of making this episode, I don't know, this is like episode 320 of Horror Vanguard, episode maybe 20-something of the Twin Peaks review, episode 1 of the 3-part-in-1 Twin Peaks reviews, episode 13, 14, and 15 of Twin Peaks. So let's all just sit with that for a second. But I think catching us up to Twin Peaks, my God, everything has happened since our last encounter with this wonderful franchise. Franchise. Oh, that sounds so dirty, calling Twin Peaks a franchise.
I just threw up a little bit in my mouth when you said that.
Cringe, me. Cringe.
Oh, look at you posting cringe.
Oh, Easter, aka Trans Day of Visibility, the appropriately timed holiday that's all themed around eggs being broken, just passed. And so let he who is without cringe cast the first podcast is what I've been saying for years.
But there is,
she is the case, maybe.
there's murder, there's gambling, there's drug running, there's arson and insurance fraud and
There's UFOs. There's magic. There's another dimension. There's possession with demons.
And all of that and so much more as we return to Twin Peaks Season 2.
Bum, 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 bum. So today we're covering episode 13, Demons, episode 14, Lonely Souls, and episode 15, Drive with a Dead Girl. Where do we want to start with Demons?
I feel like, so this is a really interesting episode, I think, as it is tying up a lot of plot that the earlier episodes in this season had lain, and setting up a lot of kind of reformulated character dynamics. So, I think we have to start with Audrey.
As with everything in Twin Peaks, we must start with Audrey Horne.
Yeah, long-time listeners will know I am an unapologetic Audrey simp. I'm sorry, I'm only human. absolute queen, legend, icon, can do no wrong in my eyes. Except if you get yourself kidnapped, injected with heroin, and imprisoned in a brothel that is run by the older men in your family.
Classic mistake. We've all been there, though.
So I kind of wanted to start by talking about just how deeply gothic the rescue scene is.
And I think this does return us to our ongoing discussion of Audrey Horne's predicament through the context of gothic literature.
Absolutely. And do you want to, I know it's been a while for people, since we've been talking about this. So do you want to kind of maybe flesh this out?
Listeners, that podcasting sub series, that you like so much is coming back in style. Little Twin Peaks jokes for the listeners at home. We include those in our Twin Peaks retrospective.
Every so often.
every so often we'll do something funny, but don't count on it. We are a theory podcast. So to catch our listeners up on the kind of predicament of Audrey Horne, I keep comparing it to the classic gothic text, the text that people often refer to as the first, quote-unquote, piece of gothic literature, Horace Walpole's The Castle of Otranto, published in 1764, and I have to look at my tattoo every time I say that, because I have the publication date of this novel tattooed on me, which is true, I am that kind of nerd. But so in Horace Walpole's Castle of Otranto, we kind of have the fleshing out of all of the central themes of the gothic, right? We have the kind of heroine who's trapped in the patriarch's evil subterranean lair. We have the chivalrous knight who's kind of questing to go save her. We have divine intervention that keeps routinely guiding the knight back on track. We have the incestuous dynamic between the father figure for our heroine and herself. All of these dynamics kind of coalesce in Horace Walpole's The Castle of Otranto, and echo forward in nearly every single gothic text thereafter. If not literally, through interpretation, almost always. And that brings us here. Yeah. Here to Twin Peaks.
So Audrey Horne has been imprisoned in One-Eyed Jack's, the illegal gambling den / brothel / clearinghouse for drugs that is north of the border. let's not rehash the whole plot, but in a complicated series of events involving a large suitcase full of money, a large briefcase full of money, Cooper rescues Audrey, who has been drugged, and brings her back to the Great Northern. It's like it all gets very Freudian whenever Audrey is around her family, you know, her daddy is there, and you're watching this and you go, maybe there's some subtext here about the incestuous sexual dynamics of a small town American ideology that seeks to literally imprison and drug women into a kind of patriarchal order. But no, it's just weird. It's just kind of kooky and surreal. But again, I I insist upon the idea that Lynch is actually making... I think a lot of Lynch's work is deeply feminist, and I think this is too. And the relationship between Audrey and Cooper continues to be one of my favorite things about the show, because it's just a very lovely example of friendship, I think, of what it means to genuinely care for someone and want the best for them. Just the heart eyes. But yeah, so the thing that I wanted to talk about is Ben Horn's reaction when Audrey is returned.
Yes.
And it's just like the most lascivious, creepy, like, dynamic, because he's like lusting after the briefcase full of money. And then he's like, oh, but it's all the while he's saying like, oh, Audrey, I'm so glad you're back home with me. And it's just... Ooh, oh, skin crawling.
Yeah, no, I think we've had a little bit of respite over the last several episodes because Twin Peaks has a lot of wacky stuff. Twin Peaks has a lot of like fun, surreal vibes. But Demons, Lonely Souls, and Drive with a Dead Girl is kind of like an infamous stretch of just absolutely like miserable gut blows. There's a scene that's in this episode where Audrey asks Cooper to drive her home. And like the very clear implication there is that, oh, she's going to tell Cooper a bunch of secret stuff. And then like Ben Horn just turns around and immediately chimes in with the like, oh, can I come with? We can all drive together. And and it's one of the creepiest scenes in all of Twin Peaks for me, because it is so clearly readable as this guy, like, just being this expert manipulator, just structuring every situation so that Audrey Horn can never actually be free.
Yeah. And really, that theme of, like, what is it? So this, again, you're completely right. This is a kind of classic gothic trope of women imprisoned in the gothic space, but it's within the gothic space that women are permitted agency. You can solve the mystery. You can explain the supernatural, right? That's like classic Radcliffean Gothic. I would argue actually these three episodes particularly are very much concerned with this dynamic of like the struggle for women to emancipate themselves. I think Audrey is a really good example of this. And I also think we have to talk about Leo. And the systems of finance that we're introduced to in this episode.
So really, really, one of the big villains of Twin Peaks that no one likes to talk about enough is the profit-driven American healthcare system.
Yes. 100%. We might need to explain this.
Okay, so Leo is now in some kind of coma. He's using a wheelchair. He's kind of stuck in his home. And he's being taken care of by Bobby and Shelley. Bobby and Shelley have agreed to take care of Leo because they got wind that if they take care of him at home, they'll get thousands of dollars in government assistance. Mm-hmm. And what we see play out in this episode is actually they're going to get like $12 because all that money is being sponged up by fees and equipment costs.
Yeah. It's Tom. Tom is the name of the insurance guy. And it's like, What's so kind of interesting is that everybody concentrates on the kind of metaphysics of the show, but actually, under the surface, it's a show, not even under the surface, actually very explicitly, it's a show about control of capital and patriarchal control of women. And those two things go hand in hand, right? So Shelley and Bobby need... So Leo is... Let us be unequivocal. Leo is a piece of shit. He, like, an awful...
Oh, totally.
An irredeemable piece of shit. Like, a violent, abusive patriarch, like, involved in all kinds... Like, makes the world a worse place just by being in it.
He's giving Ben Horn a run for his money.
But they're two very different flavors of awful, right? Ben Horn is the powerful man who can control and manipulate. Mm-hmm. Leo is, like, physically violent.
Yeah.
And, you know, Shelley has been kind of abused for years by this man. Her and Bobby have had a kind of fairly, and actually, honestly, very sweet romance. And so Leo's insurance money is Shelley's means to like freedom. But it's mm-hmm. still a freedom that's contingent upon the domestic and reproductive labor that goes with being the wife of Leo.
Yes, yes. And this is I think you bring up a really good point here, because in this episode we get this wonderful quote from Mr. Tajimura, where he says, "I find adherence to fantasy troubling and unreasonable," which I think really underscores this kind of like materialist reading of a series that is often predominantly discoursed through its metaphysics, even through a lot of our Twin Peaks retrospective episodes. And I just like, oh, like, is it this episode or the next episode that has Shelley quitting the R&R diner?
That's the next episode, and that scene I think is
we're gonna get into that.
Is so
my
so important.
Oh, go on.
It's like,
yeah, because my whole point is that scene.
Yeah, like what's the inciting incident of the entire show? It's real estate deals, right? The entire and I actually think this is such a good show for us to talk about, because, you know, we often, kind of really lazy criticism that gets thrown at like talking about horror from the left is like, it's non-materialist. And it's like, actually, like the whole systems of capitalism have material effects, but are abstracted into this kind of like spectral financial systems of rent extraction, land manipulation, capital acquisition. And it's like, if you're talking about Twin Peaks, you are unavoidably talking about political economy. Unavoidably.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about it on the lived experience of like a woman who's just trying to pay her fucking bills, or these corrupt business, these business guys, Ben and Jerry, doing business deals with Mr. Tajimura, who we will get onto in due course.
Will we ever? So I think to round out our little medical detour discussion here, Cooper, Sheriff Truman, and a few others bring the one-armed man in for questioning, and they withhold his antipsychotic medication, which allows the one-armed man persona to come through. He's no longer the kind of oddball door-to-door shoe salesman.
No, he is Mike.
Yes, he becomes Mike, and I think we get some really interesting scenes here with him that are worth dwelling on. So we get, I do believe it's Gordon Cole, asks him, "Do you suffer from schizophrenia?" Which again, I find this to be, God, we could take this, where do we want to take this? You know, we could like bring this down like a kind of like Foucault / Deleuze-Guattarian path, and kind of like question like, okay, well, like, where is the locus of schizophrenia in this scene then? You know, we have the entire law enforcement apparatus of this small town is withholding medication from an amputee to hopefully get psychic insight into the nature of a killer they believe to be supernatural.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, like there's just a mountain of material evidence that says that the owner of the local hotel chain is a rapist, a murderer, and a drug dealer, and no one seems to really mind.
Yeah, no one seems
Cooper's pretty neutral on that one. But I find that to be really interesting, right? Because like again, like, and this fits in the kind of popular discourses of Twin Peaks, where we're focalizing these kind of like metaphysical discourses, right? Like, oh, the Mike is from this other dimension and everything, where it's like, actually, well, you know, Gordon Cole is kind of really broadly asking the question, where is the suffering of schizophrenia here? Where will we locate that inside this text? And if you put some pressure on that, especially using like left theory, it's not Mike. It's not the one-armed man. Like, the locus of the schizophrenia is systemic and bound in between all of these people.
Yeah. Do you suffer from schizophrenia? That's an interesting choice of words, right? Do you suffer?
Mm-hmm.
And so the obvious question is, well, why? Why do you suffer? And again, this is classic Foucault, right? This idea of like biopolitical control is not simply repressive, but it's productive. What are you trying to produce? You're trying to produce access to a discourse of knowledge. And we'll have to get into this, because I just wrote something about Marxist approaches to crime fiction specifically. But maybe we'll get into that when we talk about Lonely Souls. But I also feel like we also have to talk about Gordon Cole, played by David Lynch himself.
Yes, yes. In proper theatrical tradition, the god of the production walks on set to shepherd his wayward cast.
I love Gordon Cole because for all we can wax poetic about David Lynch being, you know, interested in the interiority and existential freedom of women particularly, and mounting a critique of the abstracted violence of political economy under like capitalism, David Lynch is also just a weird little dude, which is just a wonderful combination.
As often the most provocative figures are, you know, at their heart, they're kind of like weird guys just doing weird stuff.
And what I love is that Gordon is clearly just a character that allows David Lynch to do shtick. because Gordon doesn't hear very well and has hearing aids in, cranked up to the max, as he tells Cooper. But it's like there's this very silly scene where he takes Cooper into Harry's office and just yells exposition in a conversation that's supposed to be private. And this is one of my favorite things about the show, is that periodically it'll just turn into like a weird little comedy show.
Yeah, that's. I mean, like there's stuff like that I find to be like really the thing that makes a lot of the Lynchian so surreal in quotes isn't the like. Oh, it's not the one-armed man talking about magicians and kind of like the very like heavy-handed stuff. It's like the fact that we get that and then we immediately whiplash to like all of these like the director coming onto the set to do a bunch of like comedy bits.
Yeah. Like him and his friends just doing some like sorry, what did you say? No, I said how was your trip?
Yeah, so at the start of this episode, the Log Lady's introduction is talking about kind of when it's difficult to be the self, you know, and she's discussing it through trauma and a few other lenses. But what I find to be really interesting about the episode that then unfolds is we have a lot of people for whom their sense of self is heavily mediated. You know, we've got Gordon Cole, whose sense of self is extremely mediated as a character, right? Because we see him and we see David Lynch, right? He's being mediated through that. As a character in Tra the Text, his entire existence is mediated via the prosthesis he uses for a hearing aid. We've got the one-armed man, whose existence is also kind of medically mediated, right? Through his status as an amputee, through his status as like someone who might have schizophrenia, might be possessed by an interdimensional being. That's kind of unclear. And we've also got Leo, and by extension, everyone in his orbit. And I find that to be a really interesting thing, that when David Lynch throws himself into this, that's the level that he's operating on in the text. He doesn't throw himself as like, I don't know, he could have done Gordon Cole totally straight and been the super important, well-respected senior detective coming in. But no, he just pops into the text as another person who's kind of imbricated and inserted into all of these really complicated discourses.
Yeah, I mean, and he is like, it's just another flattening of like normative hierarchies, right? You know, he's his commanding officer, but a lot of the time Cooper is telling him what to do or telling him what's going on. And he's kind of like it's like impotent authority. This is, and again, maybe we'll get into this more when we get into the kind of horrors of the next episode, but like, this is a very Oedipal show.
just a little bit.
it's revealing in as much as you recognize, like, for Lynch, how structuring and fundamental the Oedipal narrative truly is to this investigation of not just one specific crime or not just one individual act, but actually is the structuring metaphor of like social totalities meeting, right? It structures the world of business. Ooh. It structures the world of like finance. It structures the world of law. All of these things have kind of like, there's one economy, right? There's only one. There isn't a distinction between Ben Horn's weird sort of sexualized, incestuous desires on the one hand, and his desperate need to generate as much money as possible. Those things exist on a kind of continuum rather than as like two distinct and different apparatuses. What do you think?
I think I would pose an interesting point of discussion for that, because I think that's like obviously like the libidinal economy is such a powerful way to look at Twin Peaks because it lays everyone's libidinal desires bare. You know, not only do we see what they're desiring, but for the vast majority of these characters, we see why and how they're doing that desiring. And this I think interestingly brings us to Mr. Tajimura. A character who shows up in this episode, but we won't find out for a bit who he really is. You will at the end of this episode, but not if you're watching.
And again, there's that line about fantasy. But there was a quote that I pulled out of this episode, which is what Maddie says to James. You looked at me and saw Laura. I kind of liked it. You're completely right.
Mm-hmm.
But what is desire, right? We don't desire. We desire to be desiring, right? This is the great example in the show so far of the pervert art of cinema, right? Where you are taught how to desire. Your desire is for the desire of the other. What did James want? James wanted Laura. Right? So that's why it has to be structured across these like Lacanian triads. Once again, I end up talking about Lacan. I hate it so much. right, but like it's what does Maddie want? Right, wants to be seen as what she isn't. Right, there's this moment of kind of like subjective disjunction. Right, who are you? You are not who you are. Right. Mm-hmm. You want to be seen as the other by the other, right? So there's these kind of multiple steps that you get to see being inserted, and these kind of filter through all of those mediating structures of economy, society, family, education, law, the wider sociology of the show. Really the kind of question that drove Laura Palmer, and a question that drives so many of the people, is like, what does it mean to get to be somebody else? Right, so the agential capacity is you recognize that your life as you understand it is in some ways insufficient and kind of not correlated with your own internal sense of subjectivity, right? You realize something about yourself not only has to change, but can change. And that's the very that's the whole point of Laura living this kind of secret life and the secret diary that the episode opens with. The place where all of the things that you can't say publicly can be said. I think this is the big question of the show for so many of its characters. It's like, what does it mean to get to be someone else?
I think that's such a strong point to lead us into a discussion of episode 14, Lonely Souls. And I couldn't think of a Bouncing Souls joke to start this off with. So let's just dive right into a discussion of the bouncy ball scene. make this make sense.
We need a Twin Peaks is being a weird little comedy like sound effect here.
Yeah, we need a soundbite.
And it should just be the noise of the bouncing balls. Okay, what's the context? What's the context for it?
Okay, so Cooper has taken the one-armed man through a series of riddles and poems has divulged that Bob is in the Great Northern, right? The kind of metaphysical monster that Cooper has been hunting has been located, and he is going to use the one-armed man as something of a Bob detector by taking him to the Great Northern and kind of parading all of the guests and staff of the Great Northern in front of him. While he's doing this, there are a few dozen people in kind of naval sailors' uniforms bouncing rubber balls around. Discuss.
Okay, I have a theory, and it's a little bit wild.
Hit me with it.
Theory time. Okay. So, And this is a kind of big important point, I think, for talking about this episode. We have to talk about Marxist approaches to crime fiction. So we, if I can do this, please forgive me. Block writes about this. He writes about, there's an essay that he writes, which is published in the 60s. It's called Art in the Detective Novel. And he says this, Holmes, referring to Sherlock Holmes, fin de siècle, utilizes the scientific inductive method. He can tell from the mud on the soles of his visitors from which part of London they hail. He differentiates between all kinds of tobacco ash, and chemistry is his favorite science. Agatha Christie's character, Hercule Poirot, on the other hand, a product of a less rational time, no longer stakes his little grey cells on the inductive card, but instead intuits the totality of the case in accordance with the increasingly irrational modes of thinking characteristic of late bourgeois society. What are the bouncing balls a kind of visual symbol of? I think in a way, this is maybe a stretch, but there are it's about this atomistic, mechanistic law of the universe of crime detection, right? It's like the billiard ball theory of like subatomic particle interaction, the ball bouncing, cause and effect, right? There's supposed to be a deterministic logic, right? But because we exist in this alienated, less rational time when the discourses of science no longer hold, Cooper is not a rationalist, right? Cooper is far closer to Poirot than to Holmes, to use Bloch's analogy, right? He is intuiting not just the responsibility for one particular act, but is intuiting an entire structure of feeling that unlocks the kind of the irrational mode of thinking characteristic of all of Twin Peaks. This is a stretch, but for me, it's readable as like mechanistic, deterministic, physicalist interaction meeting this intuitive, non-rational, irrational mode of thought. And it's a very tense scene because of that repetitive rhythmic noise, right? What do you think? I realize I'm reaching a bit here.
I don't think this is a reach at all. I think the beauty of this scene, and here I will approach it from a bit more of like a kind of dry formalist sense. I think the beauty of this scene is it adds so much grit to this episode, and in specific, an already tense sequence. Because we have the one-armed man who is in a lot of like psychic discomfort as he channels Mike and attempts to detect Bob. Mm-hmm. We have Ben Horn being like, what the hell is going on? Cooper, what are you doing at my place of business? You've got all of the guests and staff who are like obviously confused and tense. You know, like Leland Palmer, who we know is possessed and evil, is just lurking in the background the entire time. And then you have all these like sailors just bouncing balls and running around like totally oblivious to what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's such a all of this anxiety, all of this discomfort cries out for resolution.
Yeah.
And we don't really get it. Like obviously the scene ends and kind of the major plot points involving Cooper and Leland are resolved. But the kind of tensions that erupt here don't resolve as much as they kind of just fade away into the background as time moves us forward. And I think the kind of discourse that you're bringing to this, the kind of like, I might get your phrasing backward here, but the kind of irrational rationalist approach to this, I think is a very powerful way to like start like attempting to resolve that sequence or attempting to give it at least the potential of resolution.
Yeah. And we'll get into this because again, what are you trying to do? So there's a really, Fred Jameson has a really famous essay about The Wire called, I think it's called Reality and Utopia. And he says that actually the point of crime fiction is to show you the social totality in which crime appears. That's what it's for. So you can't you can't like solve this tension because crime is fundamentally a social problem, right? The representation of crime in fiction is a social problem. Which means you have to talk about how do you solve crime fiction is presenting you with a solution. It's presenting you with a solution that is inevitably about which is about suturing closed the fabric of the social totality. And as this episode, I think, is expertly doing, this is like trying to go who is the guilty party is entirely insufficient.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think a really good way to look at that is during this episode, a hawk is sent to go visit Harold's house and try and find out more about the secret diary, Harold's involvement in this, do some detecting. When he gets there, we found that Harold has hanged himself. And it's a really like quick and brutal and tragic sequence of events for a character that's already been very unsettling and tragic and often manipulated throughout the plot. And I think it really like it underscores, I think, a lot of the kind of the tensions and the tragedies and like the complexity, because this is like Twin Peaks does a really good job of kind of playing out the sum totality of the social landscape of the disappearance of Laura Palmer. Like Laura Palmer's disappearance is more so heavily structured on other things like Ben Horn's crime network, but it does require everything else in order for it to happen as it happens. Like we need a society in which someone like Harold is so sufficiently tormented, ostracized, and exiled from normal social life that they're driven to suicide. Like that is a necessary prerequisite for what happens to Laura Palmer in the show. I find David Lynch to be really empathetic.
Oh, yeah,
hugely. As a showrunner and as a writer-director.
Hugely.
Yeah, hugely. Because he has a lot of the people he puts in his shows they're us. They're people who have, like, all kinds of problems. Psychic, physical, economic. They're the downtrodden, the oppressed. And, like, I don't think any of them are ever, like, played for jokes. Or if they're played for jokes, it's always, like, as part of a larger and more complicated context.
I think that's entirely true. And again, this whole theme in this episode is like, this is never individualized, right? Harold's tragic death is part of this bigger picture. And like a really good example is that it's almost immediately contrasted with Ben and Audrey again. And Audrey like confronting him, going, how long have you run One-Eyed Jack's?
Mm-hmm.
Like, did you know that Laura was working there? Did you end up sleeping with her? Did you kill her? He's completely pathetic in this scene, and like, or contemptibly so, because we have this like nasty little streak in his character of this like this incest taboo, because when Audrey was at One-Eyed Jack's, Ben went to visit someone called Prudence. You remember Prudence, don't you? What a great loaded name to have as an alias in the context of this show.
Yes.
Like, did you kill her is the big question. And again, the whole of society is structured in such a way as to let Ben Horn and Leland Palmer accumulate vast sums of wealth. But as you pointed out repeatedly, absolutely, it's like it's classic gothic patriarchy, right?
And what I find to be really interesting here with Ben Horn is that after Audrey confronts him, the kind of like big culminating moment that Ben gets here is somewhat tearfully and agonized, he confesses that he always loved Laura Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
And the camera just dramatically cuts to a picture of Laura that's nearby.
Yeah.
And I find that scene to be so interesting because with Ben Horn, you know, we have someone whose internal libidinal economy, right? His system of desires are so bound into him being this kind of, you know, gothic patriarch, to continue to use this framework, that even if that desire, that kind of like desiring confession he makes about Laura Palmer, that he always loved her, like that could very well be him as the master manipulator doing that to put Audrey back in her place, to put her on the back foot, to try and drum up a false sympathy.
Yeah.
Or if it's honest, it's just further imbricated in all of this, because like not only is he incestuous, but he's also a pedophile.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like Ben Horn is just kind of racking up all of the like creepy, horrible things that one can do in a lifetime. But a thing that I found really striking about that scene is, and how that cut is accomplished, is it really like brings out how we engage with Laura Palmer as like an object in a story, like as an element, rather, of the fiction itself, and how her status is objectified intro, the text of the show, kind of mechanically.
Yeah.
Like, we see that picture of Laura all the time, and so the camera is always cutting to it. And the camera just cuts back to it after a moment, and cuts back to it after a moment. You know, like we have the Laura Palmer wrapped in plastic sequence that will be later echoed with Maddie, which for the life of me, you can get a Laura Palmer wrapped in plastic Funko Pop. Fix your hearts or die, yep. People. What the fuck is that?
Yeah, like, did you watch the show?
Yeah, do you know why Laura Palmer is blue wrapped in plastic? Everyone who owns that Funko Pop, raise your hand if you've thought about the thing on your shelf for a fourth of a second. I know I'm so mad at Funko Pops. That's a bit that's never going to stop.
Never going to stop.
Once that company closes, once every Funko Pop is ground up and reconstituted into vital medical equipment, I will cease to complain about that company.
I think there's another really good example in this episode of exactly what you're talking about, of like the instrumentalization and like literally the reification of a woman into a kind of like object. And this is the conversation between Shelley and Norma in the diner, which is...
Oh, here we go.
Honestly, so beautiful and so, like, unironically moving. So, Shelley...
And so lesbian-coded.
It's so deeply lesbian-coded. but and also, like, so kind of, like, working-class solidarity-coded as well.
Yes!
So Shelley realizes that when bills are covered... And the insurance money is going to leave her $42 a month to live on. And Leo is going to need care 24 hours a day. And she has a job at the diner, at Norma's Diner. And so she kind of goes into work and kind of very tearfully explains to Norma that she's going to have to quit. And Norma's like, okay, this job's always going to be here. Like you're not going to be left alone. But it's like it's another example of going like, oh look, another example of how systems of finance systematically try and keep women in the role of doing unpaid reproductive domestic labor, right? Reproducing the means by which capitalism functions. This is a wages for housework moment.
All right, I'm back.
Go, go, go.
Boom. Okay, so, oh my God, there's so much to say about this scene. And all I kept thinking about my last watch of this was Sylvia Federici's counterplanning from the kitchen.
Yep, absolutely.
Right? And that old AK Press poster, I think it was originally, it might have been originally some other poster, but everybody knows it from AK Press. But the one that says, like, men and boys, the revolution begins in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Because... What's also going on in Norma's life right now is Hank, her violent, abusive, manipulative husband, is feigning a job at the Double R, working with her as a way to cover for the fact that he's just back to doing a lot of complicated crime and murdering people.
Yeah.
Like his in the entire existence of his wife for him is literally just a smokescreen for his crimes.
Yeah.
And this kind of moment of like raw intimacy, this moment of solidarity between Norma and Shelley, and kind of the raw potential it represents, like again evokes this proud Gothic tradition of storytelling, because like, you know, like in the Gothic sense, women are subterranean creatures, right? Like they are oppressed, they are forced underground in a very, the Gothic listeners, if you haven't read a lot of books from the 1700s, the metaphors are very loud. They get away with it with every book starts with like, I did not write this. I found this complete edited manuscript in an alley and I'm just going to sell it. Who knows who actually wrote it? So that's how they get away with it. But I find this to be just incredibly powerful because like here they are wielding this kind of like subterranean power, right? Like this class connection, this connection as a gendered underclass, right? They're wielding that and using that to forge an alliance as best they can in a larger oppressive structure. Like, oh my God, be less 1700s Gothic, David Lynch.
And then we come to the kind of the final 15 minutes of this episode, which are just incredible and terrifying and absolutely awful in every way, which is what happens to Maddie, and how it's presented and how it's shown, and the intercutting between what happens to her and where all of the rest of our characters are who are in the bar listening to the singer. What do you think of this?
It's brutal. Like the sequence is so unforgivingly brutal for everyone in it. And again, like we have like this is just like a long unbroken sequence of domestic violence between Leland Palmer as possessed by Bob and Maddie and Leland's wife, and how this all strings together and how it contrasts with everything that just happened in the rest of this episode. Like the more that we see of Leo and Shelley's relationship, like the more we see of like how Norma is dealing with things, and then we to like cap this episode with this, and the, oh god, the stuff with Harold at the beginning, Lonely Souls is a brutal episode.
Yeah. So Block makes this point, which I think is really, really, really good, that there is a kind of like criminological knot. Which is the Oedipus story. So he says that, like, from Poe onwards, crime fiction is about the restaging of the Oedipus problem. One recalls as Oedipus is increasingly pressing and urgent investigations carried out in the interests of his people and his own security from the murderer, yet thwarted by the most confounding obstacle. The hunter, who is himself the prey and fails in this quest of self, plies his monstrous trade until he belatedly recognizes the truth and does penitence for the perpetration of crimes in which he participates, neither consciously nor morally, but with a highly classical and highly modern ego identity. This is describing Leland Palmer to a T. Multifariously disguised, the theme of Oedipus, this primordial detective theme per se, continue to have an effect, always criminalistic to be sure, and with this hidden antecedent. So Block kind of makes the argument that crime is not just about the kind of subjective appearance of the social totality, but is about this philosophical problem of what he calls the darkness of the lived moment. Like, Cooper is sitting in the bar, like, completely, almost like blissfully ignorant for a moment of what's happening. And it's only through the formal structures of the sequence in which we intercut, and then we introduce the vision and the "it is happening again" line, that Cooper realize has this moment of, like, revelation. You move from darkness into a kind of... You understand how always already rotten the entire social structure is.
That is such a good point. And I want to talk really briefly about the horse.
Yes.
Because we have to... So this is arguably one of the most, I'll just say, memed on scenes of Twin Peaks. The Simpsons have a bit about it. And kind of inexplicably, there's like a glowing white horse. And again, this is I draw a lot of connections between this and the bouncing ball sequence. It's adding grit to the sequence, and it's allowing us to kind of bite harder into it. It's loading it up with metaphors that, like, again, like the tradition of Gothic literature, metaphors that can be. And this conversation, sidebar, this conversation is so good for helping us move the Gothic discourse away from, like, bats and spooky castles and Dracula and into the kind of, like, slow drama where the Gothic really, really gets cooking.
Yeah.
Not that I don't like Dracula, but sorry, we'll do Dracula some. We haven't done Dracula yet, have we?
No.
No. Dear God, we haven't done Frankenstein either, have we?
No.
Listeners, we run a horror movie podcast. okay, now to return to our conversation on the emoji movie, the Dracula of today. But no, so one of the things that I was kind of thinking about, because I was also thinking about these kind of like edible conflicts that are happening in this episode. And of course, I will turn our attentions now to a brief reading from Paul B. Presadio's Can the Monsters Speak? This is on page 96, class. Set Oedipus free. Join the monsters. Do not hide patriarchal violence behind the so-called incestuous desire of children. And place at the heart of your clinical practice the bodies and the voices, his, hers, and their, of those who have overcome rape and patriarchal violence, of those who already live beyond the patriarchal nuclear family, beyond heterosexuality and sexual difference, and of those, he, she, and they, who are searching for and creating a way out. So watching this episode for this last viewing I had, and seeing that horse, right? Because the conventional reading of the horse in kind of literature, and especially in the Gothic context, would pull us back in towards like these patricentric readings, right? It would pull us back towards the kind of standard, you know, like Freudian Oedipus complex type of readings, where we would see the horse as another like glowing symbol of the colonizer and of patriarchy and of oppression, you know, like the horse riding down on the downtrodden. But I kept thinking about like Presadio's writing and in the sequence and like counter reading the horse as like a moment of freedom, the thing that could yet find a way out, right? This thing that is unfortunately and unduly saddled with all of the sins of patriarchy and colonialism as a symbol, right? When it in of itself is just a horse.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I was thinking about. That's what I was thinking about. Any takes?
I couldn't agree more, actually. I really love that. I really love that. Yes, I think there's this... I think to kind of... I want to push this even further, because there's something else that I...
Do it!
I think is important, which is that this concept of the darkness of the lived moment means that not only is crime a kind of like estranging moment from society, but that we fundamentally are strangers to ourselves.
Yes.
You know, Block says, at the foot of the lighthouse, there is no light. Like, you don't know who you are, really. You construct your sense of self. Like, who is Leland Palmer? Is it useful to think about this idea of a coherent identity? Because often, I think this is true, especially in the context of the next episode, that people kind of split him. And you go, oh, there's Leland Palmer, and then there's Bob, who is like there's the bad Bob, guy. Yeah. And you go, really? Is it that straightforward? Is it that dualistic? And I think the whole point is the detective story, like a narrative of detection, is not just about these kind of ideological struggles, but about the fact that we are fundamentally strangers to ourselves. We are estranged from ourselves. And we find ourselves kind of trapped in these recursive loops of like not knowing, this movement of epistemology. And these kind of seemingly compulsive acts of restaging things, right? This is why, you know, we have the death of Laura Palmer again, but it's on screen, but it's just someone different. But it's someone who we looked at and saw Laura, right? So we see it again.
Yeah, again, it's Laura's. It's both Laura and Maddie's identities now being mediated through these series of images.
And I think that sets up things quite well for very next episode.
Yeah. I think the only last thing I'd want to say about Lonely Souls would be that like I love that point about like people tend to split Bob and Leland into two separate and distinct things that aren't fundamentally interwoven with each other. But that I think we could take that even further. And if we do that, why aren't we doing that with Ben Horn?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about Leo?
Yep.
What about Bobby? You know, what about Coop? What about literally everyone in the sequence? Why aren't we cleaving, you know, like these things which are negative or viewed as negative, character depending? You know, why don't we see them all somehow possessed by larger systemic things? And I think that, you know, the kind of like dialectics of the Leland Bob distinction really push us into very complicated territories of finding the locus of agency in these horrible crimes.
Yeah, precisely. And the kind of fundamentally slippery idea of identity. Like, who are you? What does it mean to be somebody else? What does it mean for you to have within yourself many faces, right?
Speaking of the slippery idea of identity, let's talk about a reoccurring character from this show who has some wacky views about his identity as a father. Jarring change of tone, everyone. Sometimes we get these moments of silence, and I don't know if it's because the call dropped or if it's because I just said something like so ridiculous. It's just there would be the cricket sound effect playing if we could get the soundboard working.
Do you want to talk about Drive with the Dead Girl?
I don't want to sound excited to talk about Drive with the Dead Girl. But yes, let's talk about Drive with a Dead Girl.
There's a lot of like fun kind of incidental stuff in this. We have the return of Andy.
Yes, Andy is back, and so are his sperms.
Yeah, his sperms. There's a lot of like this great exemplar of masculine anxiety is still feeling the worry, still feeling the stress. What do you think about this?
What I find to be really interesting is what Andy's character reveals more and more as the show goes on is that the patriarchy is founded on a constantly shifting and constantly uncertain base of identity. There is no way to be sufficiently masculine in order to satisfy the kind of preconceived needs of the patriarchy. And we could see this in Andy's character, and we could also see this in those tweets that people... This is memed on, but people earnestly do those tweets where it's like, fellas, is it gay to bodybuild because you're sweating with a bunch of other dudes? And we see this really played out in Andy's character because, you know, at first his tensions are, oh, can I have a romantic relationship? Can I be man enough to really get that going? And then he's got all of these tensions of like, you know, his something's wrong with his sperm, maybe some erectile dysfunction. His gun can't shoot. And then he kills a man for the police, right? He cements himself as kind of a murderer agent of an occupying colonial force, right? Like ostensibly filling the demands of the patriarchy. But no, here in this moment where he has potentially fathered a child, he still does not see himself as man enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the great tragedy of his character, right? It's the great tragedy of his character.
Yeah.
Is this reckoning with his own, like, entirely fabricated sense of insufficiency.
Mm-hmm. Someone send him some Silvia Federici.
And we also get a new man enters town. And oh boy. Norma's mother comes to town. And there's mm-hmm. there's so much here about like these kind of like misogynist standards of like what is appropriate for a woman to be. Norma's mom is like, oh, your figure hasn't changed. That's good. Oh, you're able to make real mashed potatoes. And Norma's mom has remarried and is on a honeymoon. What are your thoughts about the new father-in-law?
Ernie, we are in the Ernie zone. So I think one of there's a really telling line with Ernie, and that's when he says, I met Vivian at a Republican fundraiser. and I think this reveals so much to us about his character, right? And that's like we come to find out that Ernie's done time in jail for finance crimes. And Hank, Norma's trash dick boyfriend, to use Twitter parlance for everyone who's very online, it kind of ropes him back into crime by blackmailing him because he's been lying to Vivian this whole time about his status as a former criminal. In Ernie, I see so much of what I see in like the kind of perpetual grift that is both conservative American culture and the finance industry. Like Ernie's character draws such an interesting parallel between those two. Maybe somebody could write 1 to 3 volumes of a book that would give us a good material understanding for this. Maybe a guy named Carl could do that.
Yeah, maybe. It's a good idea. There might be something in that.
I don't know. I'm spitballing here. That sounds like something a Carl would do.
It feels very Carl coded. But
Carl coded.
But again, this is exactly what we've been saying, right? What is like, what are the crimes? The crimes are financial crimes. And it's...
Yes!
It's like the meme of, like, the astronaut looking at the Earth, where it's like, so it's all financial crime and rent extraction? Always was. Always was.
And no, like, this is also... You're so right. This is, like... Ernie's character is a necessary historical material precondition for the creation of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. We built a society that is purpose built, that is custom engineered to produce increasingly odious, increasingly conservative finance crime guys.
Yeah, I mean, and what better example of this is Leland going off to play golf? He gets his golf bag, which is full of bloody clothes. And it's like, well, what is golf? Golf is the privatization of land, the exploitation of natural resources, and the enclosure of a common shared space, all for the benefit mm-hmm. of business guys. You know, you do all your best business on the golf course. It's a means of mediating and optimizing rent extraction and capital accumulation through the instruments yes. of financial speculation.
And talk about being Trump-coded. We've got Leland, who is doing mountains of crime and finance crime, who is using golf as a way to mediate his identity.
Precisely.
Oh, Twin Peaks, the gift that never stops giving.
Well, if you want a really good example of exactly what we're talking about, there's a lot of bribery in this episode. There's a lot of bribery and there's a lot of blackmail that happens in the context of law. So Ben is arrested. Mm-hmm. Jerry turns up from being in Japan, I think, and essentially admits that he's just a little guy. He's just a little birthday boy. You wouldn't.
He's just EP.
He's just EP and jet lagged, and is terrible at his job, and is just an absolute loser. But like the best example here is like Bobby. So Bobby needs to make money, and he mm-hmm. and he figures out that Leo was behind Ben Horn's. Like he was the instrument of Ben wanting to burn down the mill. But yeah, Leo is talking with Ben, and Bobby's eyes basically turn into dollar signs. And he says to Shelley that he is going to go into business, but he's going to be an executive. And he's going to do it by blackmail. And, like, it's sort of played as a joke, but it's like, no, he's being completely serious. Because it's like, mm-hmm. Bobby gets, that's what you do if you're an executive, right?
Yeah, no, Bobby at this point, Bobby starts as kind of Leo's understudy in crime, in a way.
Yes.
And in season one, Bobby is well on his way to being like a drug runner or a hitman or something like that. But Bobby gets his taste of finance crime when he tries to con the health insurance industry for money. And now he's kind of graduated up a rung of crime class. Now he's moved on to finance crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, again, like, I mean, like, there's a really good class point about all of this, right? Like, you know, like, Ben Horn is arrested and, like, nobody still seems to care about him running a brothel and killing people and burning down buildings. It's still all centered around the kind of, like, you know, white teenage daughter of the affluent, well-liked local businessman, which isn't to downplay what happens to Laura Palmer. That's tragic and that's terrible, but it is to, like, focalize the kind of levers of social power and these material conditions that actually get the quote-unquote justice system to move. Mm-hmm. Like, how many women have died at One-Eyed Jack's for Ben Horn's amusement? We'll never know, because it's not even part of the show.
But, like, and then you get so many return... Like, Pete is back, and it turns out that there's a recording of Catherine, and Josie's back, and it's, like, all of these... So, like... Oh, we've arrested someone. We've got a good case. That's the law. But actually, you go, no, now is the opportunity for you, for blackmail to happen. You know, mm-hmm. you're going to sign over the mill and the hotel back to Catherine. there's the $5 million for Mr. Takamura that's floating around. Like, there's all of these like things that kind of suddenly accelerate as soon as the law is suddenly has like apparently quote unquote done its job.
Yes. And all of this is happening while Leland Palmer is driving around with Maddie's body,
yep,
wrapped in plastic in the trunk of his car,
swerving, singing, looking at himself and in the mirror.
And that scene too is even like so oh my fucking god, this sequence of events and the discourses it inspires. So Leland Palmer is swerving in and out of traffic because he is fully possessed by Bob and he doesn't care or whatever. And Cooper and Sheriff Truman pull him over.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, he's acting like just totally unhinged, right? He's just like, oh, I'm just so full of emotions and thoughts and feelings. Do you want to see my golf clubs? I really love these golf clubs.
Yep.
And then Cooper and the sheriff are just like, well, drive better next time. And they let him go. And I'm like, okay, like the race, class, gender,
mm-hmm,
like let's the spin the wheel of oppressive forces that allow a local successful white businessman to drive around with a woman's corpse in his trunk, swerving in and out of traffic and being a total creep. And then like the psychic FBI agent and Sheriff Justice are just like, ah, you seem all right.
Yeah. Yeah. And you go, oh no, you don't need to, because we've recaptured Gerard, who had escaped, the one who, mm-hmm, would have been a shaman or a spirit seer and is now just a shoe salesman. Yeah, mm-hmm, you're completely right, and is again another good example of the ways in which the show is about. I'm completely sure that the show is about these explorations of like irrationalist modes of knowledge. Policing is not a rational institution, right? What happens in, mm-hmm, what happens specifically in America, when, although not, I think very, what happens in a traffic stop is not a rational situation, right? It's not like an impartial, yeah, application of the law.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
But so much is going on, right? Like the pace is sort of like starting to amp up as we keep going through this.
Well, there is like a devastating crescendo,
yes,
at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
So Leland discards Maddie's body in the woods, and at the end of the episode, it's discovered, and it is kind of you're totally right. This episode is frenetic. There is so much going on. It is so fast, and then right at the end of this kind of trilogy of episodes, we just go full speed into a brick wall with the discovery of Maddie's body.
And it's very interesting what Coop says to Audrey, where he's like, go to your room and lock your door. And it's like this, mm-hmm, there's a kind of like pre-sentiment that she was in trouble. She's going to be in trouble. She's going to be in danger. And there's this attempt to like control how knowledge circulates, I think is very much implicit in Cooper's, mm-hmm, character. But yeah, the ending is,
yes,
it's Laura again. It's Laura. It's again this another body wrapped in plastic. It's another beautiful young woman. It's again, yeah, these seemingly unstoppable cycles of like compulsively restaged violence.
Just a shockingly brutal ending, and brutal in the kind of raw realism of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And once again, a further implication of like the process of investigation. Again, this is Bloch's point about Oedipus, mm-hmm, right? It's by investigating the problem that you actually uncover that just how big the problem always already was, and just how,
yes,
deeply you're involved.
Yes.
The process that you start is the perpetuation of the process that you were trying to stop.
I think that's a beautiful point to close out this discussion on. Well, I'm so happy to be back in the Twin Peaks retrospective. I'll be excited for forthcoming episodes, excited for Kyle to join the chat. We will see you in an upcoming Twin Peaks retrospective episode with episode 16, Arbitrary Law, episode 17, Dispute Between Brothers, and episode 18, Masked Ball.
Till next time, everybody.
Stay spooky. Avoid golfing.
Ha ha. Cut.
Diane, it is that we have more questions than we have answers. A new episode. New episode.
Accord. Diane, it's Sunday.
You'll get a kick out of this one. If the long history of the perception of owls reveals one thing, it is that we have more questions than we have answers.